Good afternoon, everybody. So this is a talk about exoplanets. And as you know, exoplanetary science is a single-minded quest to find other planets like the Earth, planets where we might imagine living someday with liquid water on their surfaces. Actually, that's not how I feel about this field at all. That is certainly a very appealing goal, and there has been genuine progress toward that goal, but my group and I these days mainly think about planets that might look more like this, that are about as far from habitable as you can imagine, because they're extremely close to their home star, about as close, physically close as they could possibly be. So I like finding the freaky systems, the ones that are unlike any planets that we have in the solar system, not only because they're interesting, but because we might hope to learn from these extreme cases about planet formation. To better understand that complicated process, it would be useful to see the full range of possible outcomes. And so a lot of the work I'll be sharing with you are about systems that violate many of the patterns that we see in the solar system. So to get started, I need to remind you about those features of the solar system. I realize some of you probably haven't thought about the solar system for a long time. And there are three patterns that I want to call your attention to. First is that the orbits of the planets are very nearly circular. They have a low mean eccentricity. I think it's about 0.06. And the orbits are also aligned with each other to within a few degrees. And they are aligned as well with the plane that's defined by the rotation of the sun to within 6 degrees in that case. So everything is nice and tidy and aligned. And the third pattern has to do with the compositions of those planets and their orbital distances. All of the rocky planets are on the inside from about a third to 3 astronomical units. And giant planets are on the outside, 3 to 30 times the Earth's orbital distance. Now, you might have noticed that Pluto obeys none of these rules, and we know what happens to objects that violate the rules of the solar system. Now, these patterns were explained even prior to the discovery of exoplanets by the theory of planet formation, part of which states that these planets form from within a massive disk of gas and dust and heavier elements that's swirling around the star for the first few million years of its existence. And that helps to explain why the orbits are circular and aligned with each other and aligned with the sun, because they all formed out of a cloud that had the same, from a single angular momentum. As for the third pattern, the rocky planets on the inside, the gas giants on the outside, that has a somewhat more complicated explanation. It's because the formation of planets has two steps. The first step is planetesimal growth. This is the idea that it's a very bottom-up process. It starts with the grains of dust that exist in this gaseous disk that settle to the midplane and eventually collide and stick and form rocks and boulders and work their way all the way up to a rocky planet. And many of the details of this process are still unknown or at least poorly understood, but that is the basic theme. So that's where rocky planets come from. Now, what about gas giant planets? Well, those begin as rocky planets, but they can be promoted into gas giant planets through the second part of this theory, which is core accretion. The idea is that if a rocky planet manages to exceed a certain threshold mass, which is thought to be in the neighborhood of 10 times the mass of the Earth, that is when the escape velocity from this body exceeds the thermal velocity of the surrounding hydrogen and helium gas by a large enough factor that it can start accreting all of that surrounding gas, which is much more plentiful than the solid material. And so it quickly puffs up to become a giant planet. Now, what does it have to do with the distance from the star? Well, the conditions for core accretion are much better farther away from the sun than closer in, partly because you have more solid material up there. You have things like water, methane, and ammonia that would exist as solids out there that would otherwise exist as vapor close to the star. and partly just because the orbits have larger circumferences out there, and so there's more material available to pack onto your growing planet. And so this concept developed that the solar system and all systems elsewhere have a snow line at about 3 times the Earth-Sun distance, beyond which the conditions are right for forming giant planets. And so that's why all the giant planets are found beyond the snow line. So this is a great theory, and it's worth thinking about testing it. And one way you might test this theory is to see if these patterns hold for exoplanetary systems as well. And they were thought, that was thought to be the case. That was the general prediction of most theorists prior to the discovery of exoplanets, is that we would find these same three patterns elsewhere. Now, the problem with finding exoplanets, the reason why it took until the mid-1990s for this field to get going, is that it is technically very challenging because the planets are much smaller and much darker than this star that they are right next to. It is often compared to the problem of spotting a firefly buzzing around in the vicinity of a spotlight, and you have to do this with a telescope 1,000 kilometers away. And to order of magnitude, it sort of checks out. The contrast in the brightness, the flux ratio between the planet and the star viewed from afar, depends on the cross-sectional area of the planet that's doing the reflecting, and the surface area of the giant sphere of, with the orbital distance of the planet that, over which all the light from the star is being diluted. And for the Earth going around the Sun, that comes out to be about 3 parts of 10 to the minus 10. So very challenging. And equally challenging is the separation on the sky. The angle between the star and the planet comes out to be about 10 to the minus 6 radians, which is also a very difficult angle to resolve, especially for such a high contrast. Nevertheless, this has worked in about a dozen cases, and most of my talk will be about more indirect methods, but I want to make sure that you have seen the one spectacular case where this method has worked the best. So this is the Great Square of Pegasus, for those of you who do a little bit of stargazing. And there is a star here that you can spot with a good pair of binoculars, HR 8799. And when you look at this star with one of our best telescopes, this is what you see. This is just a point source, and all of the structure that you see here is simply from diffraction and imperfections in the optics. But nevertheless, some of my colleagues have gotten very good at canceling out the light from the star using a special coronagraph and lots of digital signal processing. And what that reveals are these 4 objects here, which are in fact a system of planets revolving around this star. And if you don't believe me, you can just wait 6 years and you can see them following Kepler's laws orbiting around the central star. So this is the one case, I think, where this method has produced something really extraordinary and wonderful. Now, but most of the knowledge that we have about exoplanets comes from other methods, and almost everything I'm going to describe for the rest of this discussion. And one of those methods is based on the Doppler shift. That is, we know that both the star and the planet are moving around the center of mass of the system, and that gives us our way in, because we've gotten very good at tracking the Doppler shift in the star's spectrum, which can reveal the back and forth motion. Unfortunately, the fractional change in wavelength produced by this Doppler shift is also very small. It depends on the velocity of the planet, which is its orbital circumference divided by its period, but then it's downweighted by the mass ratio between the planet and the star because we're monitoring the star. There's also a trigonometric factor here to account for the fact that we only measure the line of sight component of the velocity. And when you run the numbers for the Earth going around the Sun, by coincidence, you also get this terrifying number of 3 parts in 10 to the 10, which is just outside the reach of our current technology. So at the present, we are unable, with the Doppler method, to detect an exact copy of the Earth going around some other star. But we aren't far from it. We're about a factor of 10 above it, and we have detected hundreds of planets using this technique. And one that I would really want to make sure you know about, which made really big news about, I think it's about a year and a half ago, is around our very nearest neighbor in the galaxy. So this is an image of the southern sky. And this is Alpha Centauri here. And this is Proxima Centauri, which you can't see with the naked eye. It's a very low luminosity star. But it is literally the closest star to the sun. And it has a roughly Earth-sized planet orbiting around it. At least there's evidence for that. You probably heard about this if you follow astronomy news at all. And if you did read about it in the paper or online, it was probably accompanied by this wonderful image that shows the surface of this new planet. And here's Proxima Centauri along with Alpha Centauri in the background, which happens to be a binary star. You can see this dramatic sunset, the mist that's rising out of this valley. And so it's important to remember that everything we know about this planet is contained on this slide. Right? This is our actual information, and it's from the Doppler method. And so what we have is the speed of the star back and forth, positive or negative, as a function of time. And the red and blue points are the data points, and they are consistent with this sine wave, which has a period of, looks like about 12 days, indicating the amplitude of the wave tells us the mass of the planet, and the period of the wave tells us the orbital period of the planet. So that is the evidence for the nearest planet for which there is evidence today. The second method we have, and which has been very productive, is the eclipse-based method, or the transit method. The idea is that we monitor the brightness of the star. And if we're lucky enough that a planet passes in front of the star while we're monitoring it, we can't see that happening, but we can see the star appear to get slightly fainter for the duration of this so-called transit. Now, the good news here is that the fractional change in flux is easy to calculate for an Earth-sized planet going around the sun, and it's 8 times 10 to the minus 5. And that is a much easier number to deal with than 10 to the minus 10. And in fact, using space telescopes, we are capable of performing this measurement, and we have found some Earth-sized planets, in fact, quite a few, using this technique. The heartbreaking thing about this technique, though, is that the probability for this chance alignment of the orbit with the line of sight so that the planet is carried right in front of the star is low. It turns out to be the radius of the star divided by the orbital distance, which in the case of the Earth is only 0.5%. So every planet at 1 AU that we find, we know that there are about 200 that are surely out there, but their orbits don't happen to be aligned just right. So in that sense, this method is powerful, but very inefficient. Nevertheless, this is actually the method that has delivered the most exoplanets today, thousands. And that's because of a recent space mission, which has actually just ended, called Kepler. We were lucky enough to have our own dedicated space telescope that did nothing but perform very precise brightness measurements of lots of stars as continuously as possible, looking among other things for these eclipses using this giant digital camera. This illustrates the reason why we needed a space telescope for this work. This is the same planet eclipsing the same star as observed both from the ground with a 1.2 meter telescope and from Kepler, which, given the effective area, has an equivalent diameter of about 1 meter. That is, it's even smaller than the ground-based telescope, but the data are much more precise. And that's because of the scrambling effect that the atmosphere has on our measurements. With the Kepler data, first of all, you don't get interrupted. This interruption occurred because the sun came up. But from space, you can have continuous staring for months or even years at a time. And so you don't get interrupted, and you can see all sorts of details that were unavailable from the ground, such as these little glitches here. That's from when the planet was passing in front of the star, and the star had a dark spot on its surface, like a sunspot. And as it passes over the dark spot, we see a positive glitch in the light curve. Here's the current scorecard. This is where we are standing right now with the discovery of exoplanets. Each point here is a particular planet that has been discovered. And what it's being shown are the mass of that planet, either measured or estimated, along with its distance from the star measured in AU, where So the green symbols here are our friends from the solar system. So the Earth is at 1 AU and 1 Earth mass. And they're color-coded according to the technique by which the planets were discovered. There's the Doppler method, the transit method, the imaging method, and microlensing, which is a fascinating method that I won't be talking about today, but has also discovered a bunch of planets. So two things to call your attention to. First of all, almost all of the planets that we have been able to detect are more massive than Venus or Earth, which are sitting at the bottom here. That's just because those planets are so much easier to detect. Likewise, for any given planet mass, the sample of detected planets occurs with shorter orbital distances. And that's also almost certainly purely a selection effect. That's a statement about which types of planets are easiest to detect. Massive close-in planets are much easier to detect with both the Doppler and the transit method. And so as time goes on, as our technology improves, we would hope to explore this region out here. Now, this is a great chart for keeping score, but it gives a very misleading impression about the actual occurrence of planets of different types around stars. If you want to understand, if you were to take a certain volume of the galaxy and count up all of the planets that are within that volume as a function of the size of the planet and their orbital distance or period, it would look very different from this diagram because of the observational biases. The best data set that we've had to try to do that is from Kepler, because the statistics are good. We found thousands of planets over a wide range of sizes and periods. And this shows one of the latest efforts to perform that debiasing. So now we're looking in the space of the size of the planet and the orbital period. Those are the things you measure best with the transit method. The red circles are detections, but it's the green contours that are indicating the debiased results, the actual intrinsic occurrence of such planets relative to other types of planets. So for example, you see there are these hot Jupiters up here, these giant planets, the same size as Jupiter or larger, with periods as short as a few days. And those are fascinating, but they are greatly overrepresented in the sample of detected planets. They're actually quite rare. They only occur about around one out of every few hundred stars, but they call attention to themselves. Much more common are these planets in here, intermediate in size between the Earth and Neptune, and with periods of around a month. So we have the hot Jupiters, and we also have these two categories of planets that Kepler has revealed. I've labeled them as rocky planets in here that are not too much larger than the Earth. And that's because whenever we have been able to measure both the size and the mass of the planets in this size range, they turn out to have densities that are comparable to the density of the Earth or consistent with the same composition as the Earth. Whereas these planets up here that are bordering on the size of Neptune at 4 Earth radii, those planets have a wide range of possible densities, including some with very low density. And they are currently interpreted as rocky planets that are ensheathed by a massive hydrogen-helium atmosphere that's causing their sizes to puff up. And so some have called them gas dwarfs. So one thing that my group has become very interested in are these guys down here, the very shortest periods. Like now we're talking about periods down to one day. We are still finding rocky planets orbiting stars that closely. And in fact, the current record holder has a period of 4.25 hours. And what's interesting about that is as close as it could physically be without being destroyed. If you moved the Earth interior towards the sun until it had a period of about 5.5 hours, that's the Roche limit. That's the point within which the sun's gravity, the tidal forces, would begin to destroy the Earth. And so the mere fact that we find a planet, this one's called KOI 1843-03, with an orbital period of about 4.25 hours, tells us that it must be denser than the Earth in order to avoid being tidally destroyed. And so what's being plotted here, these curves are curves of different compositions that vary in one parameter, which is the iron to rock ratio. The Earth is about 33% iron by mass, and the rest is rock. And this new object must be the other way around. It must be iron dominated, making it more like Mercury than the Earth is, iron rich. So that is also a clue about some process that must have taken place in this planetary system. One of the big questions that we struggle with when we're trying to come to terms with these newly discovered close-in planets is, where did they come from? Why do we find giant planets so close to their stars? That completely contradicts that whole song and dance I was doing earlier about the core accretion theory. Well, we don't know. That is an unsolved problem. All we know is that we observe these giant planets very close to their stars. And it could be that the theory was simply mistaken, and that it is possible for a giant planet to form in the protoplanetary disk exactly where we see it today. And there's a small group that are advocating that point of view. It's also possible that the giant planets did form beyond the snow line, where they are supposed to form, but that their orbits shrank due to a tidal interaction with this massive protoplanetary disk. That's called disk migration. It is also possible that the planet formed far away, and then the disk disappeared over time after a few million years, but then something else happened. The planet's orbit was perturbed due to the influence of another giant planet. They had a close encounter, or their gravitational interactions over the years caused the orbits to change their parameters gradually, or there could be a companion star that would have a similar effect. And what can happen is, if the giant planet's orbit becomes highly eccentric due to these dynamical interactions, then at one end it's coming very close to the star, where tidal forces can become substantial, and the associated friction of the flows due to tidal forces can drain energy out of the orbit and transfer angular momentum to the star, leading to the gradual shrinkage of the orbit. And so maybe that's where these close-in planets are coming from, is from these kind of scattering processes followed by tidal interactions. So one way to try and figure out which of these processes is going on and how frequently is to study the orbital parameters of these planets. If we find that they're all circular orbits that are nicely aligned with their disks, that would tend to favor these pathways. Whereas if we find the orbits are misaligned and highly eccentric, that would be a clue that this upper pathway is likely. And so one of the earliest and most surprising discoveries in this field is that these giant planets can have very eccentric orbits. So this is Doppler data for a particular planet, HD 80606. And it doesn't look anything like a sine wave. Instead, the star is accelerating towards us, and then there's this huge spike in acceleration away from us. And that is because the planet's orbital eccentricity is about 0.93. And so it has a 110-day orbit and spends most of that time out at a sort of Earth-like distance. But then once a year, it comes screaming in to within a few stellar radii of its sun-like host star. Here's a diagram with the latest results for the orbital eccentricities of the planets that have been found through the Doppler method. It's the Doppler method that gives us our best data for the orbital eccentricities. These are mostly giant planets because of the selection bias of that method. So plotted here is the eccentricity from purely circular orbits to bordering on parabolic orbits as a function of orbital distance. And you see that there's a very broad range. There certainly are lots of planets with nearly circular orbits, but it doesn't look especially concentrated down there. Especially when you're out at 1 AU, there's a very broad range. So this, to me, is a really decisive clue that dynamical processes have been important in shaping the orbits of these giant planets, at least. We also see that there is a tendency for the orbits to become circular as they get closer in, and that also makes sense in the context of tidal interactions. The closer in they are, the more rapid the tidal processes are occurring. So, but not all of the planets have been found to be on eccentric orbits. There is a whole category of planets that tend to have very circular orbits, and those were brought to our attention by Kepler. So now we're looking at transit data, brightness against time, for a particular star over the course of 450 days. And what you're seeing here, it looks basically like static, and that's just the measurement uncertainty. But then when you look a little more closely, you can see there are all of these dips here, these spikes here. Those are not artifacts. Those are genuine brightness dips, each lasting a few hours. And those are eclipses. They don't really look periodic, though. In fact, they are periodic. It's just that there are seven different periodic sequences in here. There are seven planets that are going around and eclipsing this single star. So this is an exemplar of a category of planetary systems that goes by many names. I usually call them compact multi-planet systems, where you have lots of planets packed in much more tightly than the planets in the solar system. So the inner planets of the Kepler-11 system would all fit within what would be Venus's orbit around the sun. And so these planets tend to be relatively low mass, less massive than Neptune, say. And whenever we've had the opportunity to measure their eccentricities, they come out to be small. And that makes a certain amount of sense. If the orbits were too eccentric, these systems would not be dynamically stable. So we find these dynamically cold, flat, circular orbits. This is a chart that just shows the extension of those eccentricity measurements now as a function of planet mass. When you get below the giant planets, these here represent these compact multi-planet systems, these smaller planets in close orbits. Now, what about the alignment of the orbits? How can we measure that? If we have a system of multiple planets, the Doppler and the transit techniques don't immediately give us that information. The Doppler technique is blind to these mutual inclinations between the orbits, and the transit technique requires that both orbits are aligned with the line of sight, but not necessarily with each other. They could be crossing the star with different angles on the sky. So we've had to be a little sneaky to get that kind of information. Let me show you how one of these techniques works. So if you have two planets and their orbits are exactly aligned, as I've drawn them here, then it will always be the case that the chord that the outer planet follows across the disk of the star will be shorter than the chord of the inner planet, just because the orbit of the inner planet is projected across the star closer to the center of the star because it's closer in. Whereas if the two planets have more random orientations, then there's no reason for that pattern to hold. They could have any chord length, and it wouldn't depend on orbital distance. So that's great because this ratio of the two chord lengths is something we can get directly from the eclipse data. It varies, it's proportional to the duration of the event divided by the cube root of the orbital period. It's a nice little undergraduate type problem to show that that's the case from Kepler's laws. So we can measure this ratio for any given pair of planets around the same star. And when my colleagues did that using the Kepler database, they found that this ratio is in fact biased toward positive values. As the way they've defined it, a positive value would mean that the orbits tend to be aligned. So this is a histogram of the logarithm of that ratio. And the red line here represents the actual data. The black one is just an inverted histogram to show you that it's not symmetric about zero. It is, in fact, biased towards positive values. And they also showed that to obtain a result of this magnitude requires that the orbits are aligned to within a few degrees. So they're really quite flat, just as flat as the solar system. So this is wonderful. This is a great line of evidence, but it is kind of indirect. And so it's also reassuring that in the few cases, and most of the cases, where we can measure this angle very directly, it also comes out to be small, of order a few degrees. Yes?
Isn't there also a bias to observing more of the planetary systems where they are aligned?
Yes. Yeah, if you had a sample of stars with planetary systems, some of which were aligned, some of which were misaligned, the transit survey, the detected planets would be biased towards the aligned system as well. So we might be missing a bunch of misaligned systems. That's probably what you're getting at, and I think that is true. So here's a case where we did get the information in a sneaky way. This is, again, a brightness record of a star called Kepler-94. The brightness was basically constant for a while, and then it dipped, but then it paused. And then it continued dipping, and then it reversed itself, a little bump here, and then the whole thing went in the reverse order. So what happened here? What happened was wonderful. There was a transit of an outer planet, and then a transit of an inner planet at the same time, and the silhouettes of the two planets overlapped with one another, which is what produced this, this brightening at the midpoint of the event. And as you might imagine, the characteristics of this blip here, the duration especially, it contains information about the mutual inclinations of the two orbits. And so in this case, fitting a model to this light curve was able to show that the mutual inclination is small, less than 5 or 10 degrees, if I remember correctly. Now, so my group has been recently pursuing yet another way to get this information that only works, though, for the very closest in planets. And the way this works is that there is an effect. You can measure the actual inclination of the planetary's orbit by modeling the light curve. So all of the things being equal, if we take this inner planet, which produces this light curve, flux versus time, and we tip over the orbit to have a lower inclination, that is, we're viewing it closer to face on, that changes the characteristics of the eclipse. It makes it shorter, and it causes this partial phase to be prolonged relative to the other geometry. In other words, there is information in the shape of the light curve that tells us the inclination of the planet with respect to the line of sight. And if you have two planets and can obtain that data for both of them, you can get a measure of the difference in their inclination angles through this method. Now, this was not easy. The reason it has taken so long, even though we've had the data for a long time, is it's a very fussy procedure to make sure that you can obtain this information from the noisy data. So here is some typical Kepler data. Actually, on the right here, we have some typical Kepler data, which is much noisier than it is for this bright star on the left. And the blue curve shows the best fit, assuming the planet is going right across the center of the star, 90-degree inclination. And that's the blue curve. The red curve is when you allow the inclination to be a free parameter and obtain a somewhat better fit. And here, likewise, is the same thing. The difference between these curves, to the degree we can tell the difference between those two curves, we can learn about the inclination of the planetary orbit just from the shape of the light curve. Now, these differences are subtle. That is the point of this plot, is that there's not that much difference. Statistically, there might be a delta chi squared of 9 or 10 or something, but it's hard to be sure that in the presence of artifacts and other things in the data set. So the ultimate way we convinced ourselves was through inject and recovery tests. We took the actual light curves. We injected signals of fake planets with a different period than the real planets. So it had all the noise of the original data set. And then we tried to recover those inclinations through the same process we use on the real data. And we basically get the right answer to within what we think is the correct uncertainty. So I think we can do this. And these are the results. So what we have here, these are two planet systems where there's an outer planet, and its inclination must be very close to 90 degrees, or else it wouldn't be transiting. But then we have an inner planet, and we can measure its inclination. And that's what's shown here, is the inclination difference between those two orbits as a function of the orbital distance of the inner planet relative to the radius of the star to normalize. This is 10 times the radius of the star. And what you see, this black line here at the top, that's the curve above which you just wouldn't get transits of the inner planet. So it's only possible to obtain data below that curve. But what's interesting is that down to about a over r of around 5, we do see the inclinations are quite similar to within a few degrees. In other words, we don't see any objects up here, even though we could have. But interior to that, we do see a broader range of inclinations, including some ranging up to 15 degrees, which is considerably larger than the planets in the solar system. So this, to me, is evidence that the very innermost planets have been perturbed, or at least are somehow different from the more wide-orbiting planets, that they're dynamically hotter. There's also another bit of evidence that those planets are different. If you look at the period ratio between the outer planet and the inner planet, the same ones where we are seeing a broad range of mutual inclinations are the ones where the period ratio is largest. That is, there is a category of planets that are more dynamically decoupled from the next planet out, and also have higher mutual inclinations. So, that's all I have about mutual inclinations between the orbits. What about the pattern that in the solar system, the planet's orbits are aligned with the rotation of the sun? How can we make the equivalent measurement for exoplanets? Again, all we have is a point of light. We cannot resolve the star, much less the silhouette of the planet going across. So how can we possibly get that information on the orientation? We actually have a bunch of techniques to do this. It's remarkable. One of them, the one I love the best, relies on a fusion between the transit method and the Doppler method. The idea is, during a planetary transit, we see the brightness of the star go down against time. But if we could view this same event through our Doppler spectrograph, then what we would see is that the star is half blue shifted. That's the half that is approaching us and is Doppler shifted to the blue. And the other half of the star is receding from us due to its rotation. And usually those two effects cancel out because of the symmetry of the star. There's no net Doppler shift either way. But if there is a transiting planet blocking some of the blue light, then we will observe a net red shift in the integrated light from the star, which then disappears as the planet crosses the symmetry axis and it turns into an anomalous blue shift on the other side before going back to baseline. So this is wonderful because if the planet and the star are well aligned, you observe this signal, this red blip followed by an equal and opposite blip to the blue. But if we tilt the star by some crazy angle and leave everything else the same, now the planet might be over only the red side of the star throughout the entire transit, and so we only observe an anomalous blue shift. So that's the game, is to conduct precise Doppler observations during a transit, and we can measure the angle on the sky between the star's spin axis and the planet's orbital axis. So that's a wonderful technique. And nature has also been very kind, and it turns out that there are a whole range of orbital obliquities, as these are called. We do see lots of systems that are well aligned, where you have a red shift followed by a blue shift. We also have a collection of systems where the planet is apparently going over the north and south poles of the star, and even some that are going almost exactly backwards. So the star is rotating this way, and the planet is revolving in the opposite direction. So that, too, is a gross violation of the expectations we had based upon the solar system. This chart shows, though, the sad thing about this effect. This is called the Rossiter-McLaughlin effect, or the RM effect, which is that all of the existing data pertain to hot Jupiters, more or less. They're all up here at large planet size and short orbital periods. And so all of the dots here are the different measurements. The ones that are darkly colored are the ones that are misaligned. So there's a bunch of aligned suns, a bunch of misaligned, but they're more or less all close-in giant planets, and that's for practical reasons only. These measurements require painstaking spectroscopy, and that's only possible in the best, most favorable cases, which means the planet has to be as large as possible, and it also helps that the transits are very frequent and easy to schedule and observe. So we need to see whether this phenomenon, these misalignments between the spin and the orbit, to see whether they are common in general, and to gain some kind of understanding of what causes them, we need to expand these measurements to a wider range of planets, including small planets. And one method that can be used is also a wonderful method. It's based on astroseismology. This is the study of the oscillations of a star as a fluid body. If you take the Fourier transform of a light curve of a star over many years, as we have obtained with Kepler, you see lots of structure. There's all of this low frequency structure down here from various phenomena, but out here at frequencies that correspond to periods of minutes, 10 minutes or so, you see this forest of spikes. Those are the normal modes of the star that are oscillating because of turbulence, because of convection within the star is exciting these resonant modes, each of which has its own frequency. So that's great. How does this relate to the obliquity? Well, the obliquity is encoded in the fine structure of the spectrum. So if you zoom in on these individual peaks, They can be classified by spherical harmonics, as usual. You have an L and an M quantum number. And usually, modes that have the same radial profile and the same L, but different M's, those differ only by rotation. And so their frequencies should be the same. But in the presence of rotation, if the star is actually rotating, those frequencies are not exactly the same. So you see little multiplets in this seismic spectrum, and that's what gives us our way in this case. So here you have three modes that only differ in the quantum number M, that is, they're just related by rotation. These are the profiles of those oscillating modes. And they all have slightly different frequencies, so we can see them and measure their amplitudes individually. Now, if the star is oriented like this at high inclination, we actually can't see this mode. I didn't say it, but the way we detect these modes, the reason they show up in the light curves, is because at any given moment, one part of the star is slightly fainter than the other part of the star, and so you can see the oscillations in the brightness of the star. But for this particular mode, we're blind to it, because when this part of the star is faint, this is the same moment at which the star is bright, and so the amplitude is very low. Whereas we see this mode and this mode at full strength. But if we now turn the star over and view it at low inclination, which would mean a gross misalignment with the orbit if it has a transiting planet, now we see the central mode at full strength, and it's the modes on the sides that disappear and go to low amplitudes. So if you assume that these modes are excited to the same intrinsic amplitude, which seems reasonable given that how closely spaced they are in frequency, then if you observe their relative amplitudes, you can learn the orientation of the star. Beautiful technique. It actually seems to work. This is what real seismic data look like. It's been applied to maybe a dozen systems with reasonable accuracy. And in all of the cases, except for one I'm about to show you, except for two, including one I'm about to show you, it has shown this double peaked profile. The gray here is the smooth data. The blue is the model. These are consistent with two peaks. And if you remember, when you see two peaks, that means you're viewing the star, that the equator is lined up with the line of sight, high inclination. So that means spin orbit alignment. The relatively new result, which I obtained with a collaboration with my colleagues at the University of Tokyo, is for a star called Kepler-408. And this is a star where the multiplets are centrally peaked, even though we did have the resolution to have been able to split them. So if the star had a low obliquity, if it were aligned with the orbit of the planet, we would have seen something more like this blue dashed curve, the marginally resolved double peaked structure. But we didn't. It's actually centrally peaked. And the fitting a model to these data shows that the star is misaligned by about 45 degrees. So this now is the same chart I showed you before, but with the blue dots representing the systems where the seismic method have delivered the obliquity. And Kepler-408 here is by far the smallest planet that we have now that is known to be misaligned. So it is our first clue that even for these rocky planets that are close to their stars, they can have gross misalignments between the stellar spin and the orbit. Also consistent with this picture I described earlier of the randomization of the orbits of those close-in planets. Now, what I find especially interesting is there aren't too many stars like Kepler-408 where we could have performed this measurement. It requires a very bright star with certain characteristics. I would say maybe a dozen or so stars where we could have detected this inclination being low, and we detected it in one of them. That tells us that this is not such a rare phenomenon. The inclination angle is only one aspect of the three-dimensional angle describing the stellar spin axis. And so if we measure 1 out of 10 that's misaligned in this direction, it means there's probably several out of 10 that are misaligned in ways that this method is blind to. So this is not a freak phenomenon. All right, so where does that leave us? I began with these patterns that were expected to be universal if our theory of planet formation needed no modification. Well, at the moment, we can start to build a similar list of properties for the exoplanets about which we have some knowledge. This is a first attempt at such a list. First of all, nature does seem to distinguish between giant planets and small planets. The giant planets occur rarely around sun-like stars. About 5% of sun-like stars have a giant planet, with the important caveat that I'm talking about close-in planets, planets with orbital periods less than a year. much closer than Jupiter is to the Sun. Okay, so those planets exist, but they are rare. And furthermore, they have a very broad range of eccentricities, ranging up to 0.93. Then there are the smaller planets. Those are much more common with periods less than a year. If you pick a random Sun-like star, there's a 1 in 3 chance it'll have at least one of these. And they often occur in these compact, flat, circular systems of multiple planets, 6 or 7 planets all packed in close together. So that is interesting. That's a whole mode of planet formation that we were unaware of before these recent discoveries from Kepler. And then there's the host star, which we've seen is sometimes misaligned by quite a bit with respect to the orbits of the planets around it. Another point that I could have made about the solar system is that there's only one sun. Well, that turns out not to be universal as well. We have a growing collection of planetary systems that have more than one host star. This was the first one that was recognized, called Kepler-16. Here's the brightness record over the course of almost 2 years. And you see a whole bunch of different kinds of eclipses. You have these deep eclipses that are colored blue here that are 13%. But then you also have 3 other types of eclipses that are almost but not quite periodic. And the reason for that is because here we have a pair of stars orbiting and eclipsing one another. That produces 2 of those types of eclipses. Star A eclipses star B eclipses star A. And then you have this planet whose orbit is looping around both of those, and every time it comes around, it eclipses one star and then the other. And so this is, I think, incontrovertible evidence that such planets exist. And this was very important because before this discovery, it was not a foregone conclusion that such planets could exist. It was thought maybe in the presence of the constantly shifting gravitational field from the binary, the dust in the surrounding protoplanetary disk would not be able to stick together and coagulate and eventually form planets. Equally important is that it shows George Lucas was correct, that there really are planets in the universe where you can look out and see 2 suns in the sky. And so we have a limited collection of these. There's only about a dozen that are known. But the statistics indicate that they're not too unusual, that the probability of finding a giant planet exterior to a binary star is not too different from the probability of finding a similar type of planet around a single star. So I have been going on and on about Kepler, which is a wonderful mission that has just ended and delivered so many planets and so much great information. So you would be forgiven for wondering why we suddenly need another NASA mission to search for more transiting planets. Didn't we just do that? And the answer is yes, we do need another one, and we have one. And let me try to explain why. So Kepler, wonderful though it was only able to view, for most of its mission, this particular area of the sky, about 10 degrees on a side. This happens to be in the bordering the summer triangle. And so we are in this peculiar situation of knowing about all of the weird and wonderful planetary systems that happen to be in the direction in the galaxy where Kepler was pointed. Even though we know that statistically those same kinds of systems must exist all around the sky, much closer to the Earth. And the reason that that's unfortunate is because most of these measurements that I've been describing, especially the ones that rely on spectroscopy, require the star to be very bright so that we still have some signal when we dice up the light into tens of thousands of different wavelength bins. And so what happened often with Kepler is we discovered some planet, it's great, we know it's there, and we want to know more. We want to measure its mass. We might even want to study its atmosphere or measure the orientation of the star, but we are stuck because the star is too far away and it's too faint even for our largest telescope. So that is the whole reason to be for this next planet-finding mission, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, which will perform a wide field covering most of the sky transit survey to try to find the same kinds of planets that Kepler found, but around stars that are much brighter and closer to the Earth. So this is a real mission. It was launched last April from Cape Canaveral on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. And the way it works is it has four wide field cameras backed with CCDs. These are refractive optics and a special design that allows good performance, good imaging performance, or reasonable imaging performance over a very wide field of view. But these are very modest telescopes. The opening is only 10.5 centimeters as opposed to a meter for Kepler. And our largest ground-based telescopes are 10 meters. So these are really, you shouldn't think of these as giant telescopes. These are really more like glorified telephoto lenses. This gives you a sense of scale. And the test spacecraft has four of these. And they're all canted at different angles. So they're pointing in different directions at a given time. And the way we get the whole sky is that at any moment, these cameras are monitoring a tall rectangle from the four different fields of view of those cameras. And then we divide up the sky into sectors and observe each one for about a month. Then in year two of the mission, we go to the other hemisphere and cover that as well. So over the course of the initial two-year survey, we'll cover some 90% of the sky looking for transiting planets. Now, the big trade-off that was made to cover the whole sky in a reasonable time and a reasonable budget is in the time domain. Kepler looked at that one field for 4.5 years straight. TESS is not going to do that, at least not at first. The initial two-year sky survey will only spend a month on each of these sectors. So a star down here is only observed, we only get 1 month of data. But up here, where the fields all overlap, we do get up to a year, but still nothing like Kepler's 4.5 years. So TESS is almost exclusively going to find the close-in, short-period planets that I and others have become so fascinated with. This is some real TESS data. You know, for years I've been talking about TESS and describing all of the simulations that we've been doing. So it is a special pleasure to be able to show you what a genuine TESS image looks like. So these are each of these down here is the field of one of those four cameras. We're doing the southern sky first. This is the Large Magellanic Cloud and the Small Magellanic Cloud. This is a close-up of just 1/4 of one of the four camera fields to show you how many stars we get to monitor. And very recently, TESS has started actually delivering the planets. And so I can also show you one of those. This is an image of the constellation of Mensa, which you've probably never heard of. It's probably the most boring constellation in the sky with faint stars, but happens to have a star called Pi Mensae that I am told is just visible to the naked eye from a really good sight. And it has one of these close-in rocky types of planets. So here we have the transit signal that was measured by TESS. And it's what was also wonderful about this, what will be common situation with TESS is this star was already known to have planets from the Doppler surveys, which naturally targeted the brightest, nearest stars to the Earth. So we already knew that there was an outer giant planet on a highly eccentric orbit, and those same data, once we knew there was a planet there with a certain period from TESS, those same data also reveal the sine wave from this newly detected inner planet. So that's one of the great things about TESS. Not only will it give us planets around brighter stars, but those same stars have already been investigated for giant planets and more distant planets through the Doppler method. So there's a nice synergy that we're approaching. I think the reason we were ultimately approved for the TESS mission is that it was perceived, I think correctly, to be an important bridge between the Kepler mission, which taught us all about the weird, wonderful planets that are out there, and our next big general purpose telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, to be launched in a couple of years, which will be especially good at characterizing these planets that we find, and especially measuring properties of these planets' atmospheres. It would be very strange, it would be perverse, really, to use the Webb telescope to look at Kepler planets when we know statistically there must be a similar planet around a star that is 30 to 100 times brighter. So that is one of the main reasons to fly TESS, is to identify good targets for James Webb, along with all of our other favorite telescopes on the ground that are often starved for photons. So I'll also just leave you with the news that TESS data are going to be released to the public at a very aggressive rate. That is, it's coming soon. There's already been released data for 100 or so planet candidates, and within a few months, we're going to start delivering the imaging data as well. So if you've ever been curious about anything on the sky and would benefit from having at least a month of precise photometry, and as long as it's bright enough to be observed with a 10-centimeter telescope, we can get you that data. So I hope that it finds some use even outside of exoplanet science. And thanks for your attention.
Questions?
I wanted to ask you about these various theories of planetary formation and whether this new data from radio telescopes where you can directly image the protoplanetary disks have contributed anything to the understanding.
That's a good point. That's a very recent development. It's also exciting, which is that with a new telescope, especially called ALMA, it has been possible to image the details of these protoplanetary disks and to see features in those disks that probably come from planets, either through gravitational perturbations or otherwise. That is extremely helpful because a lot of these problems would be solved if we knew what these systems looked like early on when the planets, during that epoch of planet formation. So, have we learned anything really new from that other than that the planets exist? I'm not sure. I would have to think about that. What would be really nice is to see if we see these hot Jupiters at those early times. That would indicate that the disk, that it migrated inward at that very early time, but those cannot yet be detected. So it's a field that's just starting to awaken, but nothing comes immediately to mind that would rule out one theory or another.
I have another question. So in the binary stellar systems, people sometimes can see the influence of gravity of one star on the atmosphere of the other through the abundance of elements because it sort of mixes up the atmosphere and affects abundances. Hmm. Could these giant planets that are close to the star due to various tidal forces sort of modify the elemental abundances in atmospheres of stars over time?
Yeah. So I actually didn't know that about the abundances. I know that close binaries can distort the figures of the stars out of spherical and change the brightness distributions of the stars. I didn't know about the abundances, but
they can affect mixing effects.
Okay, I see. I don't know if that would happen with planets, but it is possible to see the tidal distortion of the star from a massive close-in planet. And it's also the case that there's a growing body of evidence that stars sometimes ingest planets, that planets spiral inwards or get tossed inwards, presenting surface abundances of heavy metals that are higher than normal.
One thing I realized in your presentation about the direction of the Kepler telescope was that it was directed tangentially to the disk of the Milky Way. So all the stars that Kepler observed are around the same distance from the center of the galaxy as the Sun. Do we expect any peculiarity by when we look with TESS to stars that have different distance from the center of the galaxy?
So there's no evidence for any such differences, but you might think of reasons why that would be the case, because the chemical compositions of the stars, the detailed abundances, do vary from one place to another in the galaxy. And that might have some bearing on the composition of the protoplanetary disk and the planets that would emerge. Now, TESS isn't really going to help so much, because TESS is really just looking in our little neighborhood where the stars don't have that much variation in chemical composition.
Okay,
for the transit method to find the extra planet, we may omit or miss the very tiny, like Mercury, this kind of planet, because this is very small. Is it possible for whether we can use a fold or beam method to find this kind of small?
So I think I heard the first question, which was,
The method is the beam method, because if it is very tiny in the night curve, we cannot distinguish the right. drop down. But yeah. if we fold several orbits, and the drop down may be with a higher significance.
That's right. Yeah, all of these transit searches rely on folding or spectral methods to increase the signal to noise by combining the multiple events. Nevertheless, even with that, there is some upper limit or some lower limit on the size of the planet that you can detect around a given star. So there's the transit method is strongly biased in terms of planet size and in orbital period.
Could you comment on some of the other trends, not just alignment of the planets with each other, but with the galactic plane? Do planets tend to align with the galactic plane? Does the star tend to align with the galactic plane? Is one more than the other? And also, is there a relationship between the size or the mass of the star and the speed at which it rotates? Mm.
So your first question about the alignment of the orbits with respect to the galaxy, the short answer is we have no information, because we don't know the angles of the orbits on the sky. We're just seeing points of light. So it's kind of funny. We can measure the angles relative to each other within the system, but not relative to east or north. A longer answer is that I don't know why one might expect any such correlations on large scales, since the planets originate from different clouds at different times. Let's see. The second question was about the rotation of stars and its relationship to the mass of the star. There certainly is a relationship that stars like the sun tend to rotate slowly, in the sense that the sun's rotation period is about a month, and that's very typical. Stars that are more massive than about 1.3, 1.4 times the mass of the sun rotate much faster, with rotation periods of a day or shorter. And the physics is thought to be understood. It's because stars like the sun on the low mass side have strong magnetic fields, which are generated by a thick convective layer on the exterior of the star. And that allows the sun to lose angular momentum through a magnetized wind. And more massive stars do not have those thick convective envelopes, no magnetic wind, and so they don't slow down. They retain the initially rapid rotation rate that it had at Earth.
I have a question. You mentioned at one point that you observed a correlation between the amount, the mutual inclination of two planets and the ratio of their orbital periods.
That's right.
Do we have a theoretical understanding of why that might be?
I do not, but I think there have been a couple of papers that have tried to explain both of these phenomena, that you start out with I hope I get the details right. You start out with a more normal compact multi-planet system that's flat and the planets have period ratios of order 3 or 4. But then there's chaos over time, dynamical chaos, which can result in the innermost planet getting both tipped over and tidal interactions would then cause the orbit to shrink. And so you would see that its period has gone down, so the period ratio has gone up, and its orbit has been inclined. So there is a theory that links both of those observations.
More questions? Let's thank him again.
Thank you.